So today's meeting is on the topic of computer-intensive methods. The next week's meeting is going to be also focusing on another type of computer-intensive methods in research design. It's actually, in both cases, you could call it simulation, although this topic is more about aiding classical hypothesis testing with computer-intensive methods. Definitely next week's class is going to be more interesting, more kind of inspiring, I think. But this is also interesting. What is this? Security alert. We don't... I don't know what this is. Okay, I think I got out of that. I also wanted to say one thing, to tell you about one thing. Next week, I will have to finish our class earlier because I have a 7 o'clock meeting at, and I can do it in my office, but I'll have to finish maybe 5 to 7, so 15 minutes earlier. It's going to be our last meeting. And the material, I think we will finish. There's not that much of the material. So we'll finish just a little bit earlier. Today, the computer-intensive methods, it's essentially about three techniques that involve using computers to help with classical hypothesis testing. And computers offer essentially a wealth of possibilities with respect to experimental design and hypothesis testing. You noticed the last topic, causal discovery, that was also this new thing that would not be possible without computers, because there's a lot of calculation, lot of things that have to be done in order to find the causal structure. These methods are all really simulations, and they are based on the laws of large numbers. If you have a large sample, then the statistical estimate of specific parameters in the sample is going to be approaching the value for the entire population. So we can have, when we have a computer, normally the classical approach without a computer is we can when we know the sampling distribution, actually we assume or we infer what the sampling distribution is going to be under the hypothesis H0, and then we calculate the probability of seeing that thing. So let's say the difference of means, we assume that mean is distributed normally, which is a very good assumption, by the way. And then we calculate the probability that the mean is different from something, and that gives us a mechanism for rejecting or accepting the hypothesis H0. Historically, that has been the approach, but when we have computers, then we can essentially perform a lot of things just by simulating them. On the next slide, I have two distributions, two histograms, and they essentially, when you look at them, can you distinguish between them and say which of them has been created by means of simulation, which of them has been created by theory, normal distribution. It is very difficult to distinguish. In fact, I don't see any difference. Let me show you just to... I think I had somewhere, if not in this directory, I'm sorry for this here, if not in this directory, then somewhere else I have... Uh, Let me quickly check this. What is this? I wanted to show okay, here's actually also an attempt to do simulation, but I wanted to show something else. Let me quickly check if I have it by any chance in my other directory. Maybe here, maybe this is the one. And yeah, this is interesting, but this is not what I wanted to show you. Would it be perhaps in my... in this directory? No. Oh boy. Let me check if I have it in... sorry for this thing, but it's something that... that is really interesting to just see that is working and playing an important role. If I go to the demo of the program, let me see if I have that example. I should have prepared it. Here. I may not have it handy now. What a pity, because I have I had a nice way of showing the power of simulation, generating things from a normal distribution by means of simulation. Unfortunately, I think... no. Well... A pity. I don't have it handy. But let me show you what we can, the things that we can do with this, for example. If I want to generate something from a given distribution, this is just showing us if you are to test the hypothesis, for example. That of a distribution, if you want to find out what kind of distribution this will be, how it will look like, there is really no way you can do it in an analytical way. You cannot show with a formula what this will look like. Any guesses what this will look like? It's going to be probably very, very hard to predict. I'm generating a random number from uniform distribution, multiplying it by a number from the normal distribution, and if it's bigger than zero, then the result is a number from triangular plus beta. Otherwise, it's from a uniform times normal, that's another number, not the same number, divided by beta plus 5. Very hard to predict what this is going to be. So with simulation, you can do things like that. If I do the calculation, I go inside this and look at the samples. The definition of this variable is that it's going to be a uniform distribution between 0 and 100. And here we are. It's theoretically, it should be a flat line at 1%. But look, it's very close to that. And the number of samples, let me check how many samples we have, inference. We have 1 million samples. If it's not flat enough, let's make it 10 million samples. If I run it now, it's going to be even closer. Now it generates 10 million samples, if I go there, look, it's so close to the line, amazingly. If it's not flat enough, then I can increase the number of samples too. So sampling is something very, very reliable. Probability theory also. If I flip a coin 10 times, I get a number of heads and a number of tails. It's going to be maybe 6-4, 3-7, whatever. If I toss it 1,000 times, it's going to be very close to 500. If I toss it 1,000,000 times, it's going to be very close to 500,000. Amazing. So now I'm essentially generating 10 million times a number from uniform distribution between 0 and 100, and I'm plotting a histogram of those samples. Look how nicely it looks. Normal distribution, the same thing. Here is, I generate a number from the normal and mean 0, standard deviation 1. Look at the histogram of that distribution. If I fit a distribution, if I, let's say, plot a PDF, it's close to perfect normal distribution. So reliable, even though it's random. Triangular, the definition is essentially, I'm generating a number from a triangular distribution between 0 and 100 with a maximum of 30. Look at that. These are the samples. Oops, sorry. These are the samples. And if I just draw a line, it's close to the ideal perfect triangular. Beta distribution, that's another one. This is a beta distribution I need to switch this off. Perfect thing. So now I can also, by simulation, I can see how this complicated formula will look like. This is what it is going to look like. Very difficult to solve analytically, but I can do it by means of simulation. And with enough samples, I can simulate anything, really. It's just amazing. So this, you know, it generated 10 million samples. Of course, doing it by hand would be impossible. So computer gives us this very inexpensive tool to repeat things, to simulate them. And that's, I guess, an idea that is, it's a revolution in many things that we can do. Let's go back and with this idea that we have almost like a tool, like a slave, who does things for us, we can do this kind of stuff. As I said, there are three different approaches to supporting classical statistical tests by means of computation. Monte Carlo tests is an easy way to get a sampling distribution when the underlying population is known, but we don't know the sampling statistic. Let me actually do something else. Do the duplication of the screen, and now I can show the slideshow. Here it is. But I can stop for a moment and show you again this problem that I just showed. When you look at this variable and the definition of this variable, it would be very difficult to perform a classical statistical test. So suppose you know that your sample comes from this distribution. It's a weird thing, I just kind of randomly, out of my head, created this definition. Now, can you perform a statistical test on that? Can you compare the sample that you got and compare it to the 5% tail of that distribution? Theoretically, it would be very, very hard because I would need to have the plot of this distribution. So I would have to derive that plot somehow, and the doing it theoretically is very hard, but I can derive it by means of simulation, like this one. Now I can easily say, okay, this is the 5% tail of that distribution. Does my sample fall in that tail or not? I can do it. But I can derive this distribution by means of simulation. So that's essentially the essence of the Monte Carlo approach. We know the underlying population, so we know the formula, we know how to generate it, but we don't know what the, for example, what the mean of the distribution is. We don't know it. Essentially, here's an example from the textbook, but this is even better, the one that I showed you. You know, you want to know the likelihood of seeing four heads in five coin tosses. Not an easy problem to handle. You can simulate five tosses. You can toss a coin five times and do it many, many times, let's say 1,000 or 1,000,000 times, and you can count the occurrences of more than four heads. So you can essentially derive the statistic from the simulation. And that's the idea. And that's very close to a lot of engineering applications that you are probably working with. You essentially design a simulation by means of a computer if you know how a physical system is working, and then you can use the computer to perform many simulations, and you can calculate the probability of something. Here is one example that is also impressive. Let me click on that. You know the Monte Hall problem? Mm-hmm. You know it, yes? The Monte Hall, because there was a guy who was the TV host. I think this is an ad. So this is the game. Three doors in the very final stage of the game, and the host is asking, which door do you pick? Suppose you pick, I can play, yes? You pick this door. The host is opening one of the other two doors and shows you that there is a goat behind it. And the question now is, should you switch from this door to that door? The host is giving you an opportunity to switch from the original door to this door. And the question is, should you switch? So you've seen this problem, you've seen it. What about, have you seen it? No. Now the question is, should you switch? So again, three doors, two of the doors have goats, and one of the doors has a car behind it. You pick one door, and the host, who knows where the car is, opens another door out of these two, and the host knows where the car is, so he always opens the door with the goat. So now the question is, should you switch between this and this door? And it's very counterintuitive. People often don't get it. Even statisticians often disagreed with should you switch or not. The answer is you should switch. You should change from this door to that door. You can show it analytically using Bayes' theorem that the probability of the car being behind this door is still one-third, as it was before. But after opening one of these two doors, the probability of the car being behind this door is two-thirds. So this door is more likely to have the car. Let's click it. Oh, we were out of luck. But the car was there. But still, the probability was higher that the car is here. We can do the simulation. When you do the simulation, let's do it not 100, but let's do it 1,000 times. And we keep the choice of the door, so we don't switch. Start the simulation. Ah, it's going to take too much time. Instant is better. Look at that. With 1,000 times, if you keep the choice, you get the car with roughly 3% probability, and if you change, you get it with 50% probability. Why 50? It should be 60. One half. Stop. Let's stop it and run again. Simulate. Okay, the simulation actually finished here. I would have to recall why it's 50 and not 66%, but I'm surprised. Change the choice. Simulate. Here we are. Okay, because it recalculated just the bottom. Now it's 67% if I change. So it's twice as likely to choose. In any case, please know that it's very reliable. Every time I do the simulation, I do it again, and again, and again. Oh, I have to do it this way. Again. Fortunately, it's wasting time. Again and again, I'm getting very reliably close to 33 and 67. Why is it 37? I don't know. I'm very suspicious about it.
Because we have only 78.
Because it's not it's not recalculating this one.
Yes.
It's just recalculating the top.
Only the chosen option.
Yes, only the chosen. Okay, so please note how reliable it is. Every time we do it, we get close to 66.6, which is 2/3 probability. Every time reliably. Every time I do that. This is probability theory and statistics in action. So we can do it. The basic procedure for doing this is essentially you decide about the size of the sample. And these days, the size of the sample, who cares? It's so fast that you can make it a million, you can make it a billion if you want to. If it's not enough, you can leave it for an hour or the whole weekend and make it gazillion. Yes. And the more samples, the more precise it's going to be. Although you get an idea already with a small number of samples. With 100,000 samples, you get very close to the predicted. And then you repeat k times, you draw a sample, pseudo sample. So you perform the simulation, like and then you record the population of record the value of your statistics, like the mean, and then you can perform this classical test, saying, okay, if the like the statistic based on the sample is larger than the one that you are comparing to, you increment by one. And then the proportion gives you the probability of that event, that thing that you are looking at. So like in the simulation with cars, you get each time, you get the, essentially during each simulation, you get the probability, you get the event, you get the car or don't get the car, and after running it for 1,000 times, you get precisely how often you get the car, for example. So this is just a Monte Carlo, basic Monte Carlo procedure. The example from the textbook, so there's a nice textbook called, it's by Paul Cohen, it's Research Design for Artificial Intelligence. He gives one example from that he describes. In his faculty meeting, let's say, they perform admissions of students. And they notice that two consecutive years of admission of students, they have they change the admission policy. So they are doing admission in a different way. But then they notice that the interquartile range in the test scores of admitting students is different. And the question is, are they significantly different? What is the interquartile range of test scores? Essentially, the test scores are going to be distributed, probably, generally, this is the distribution of the test scores. It's going to be normal. Why? Because it's a mean. Distributed like results of any exam. It's going to be a normal distribution. We talked about the normal distribution, the central limit theorem, yes? When you have a sum of this is a different class that I taught on Thursdays. When you have a sum of variables, then this sum is going to be distributed as a normal distribution. That's a theorem that is very, very powerful. So when they admit students, you can say that their test scores, in a large university, they admit 40, sometimes 50 PhD students every year. In a big university like Stanford, in one department, by the way, because there are many departments. So then they notice that if you divide it into four quartiles, 25%, 25%, 25%, 25%, one way of measuring this is the interquartile range. For example, the that value, let's call it Q1, in one year it was Q1, in another year it was Q2. So the bigger the range, the bigger the variance among the students. So you can say you change the admission policy, and then the students in the other year are essentially, there's a bigger variance. So there are, some students are really very, very good, some of them are really worse than they used to be last year. So now the question is the interquartile range in the second year, is it different than the interquartile range in the first year? And there's no statistical test that you can perform, because what is the distribution of the interquartile range? We don't know it. We know the distribution of the scores, we know it, but what is the distribution of this statistic? We have no idea. And if you remember, classical hypothesis testing is there is some distribution of some statistic. Let's call it the interquartile range distribution. Once we have that, we can easily perform a classical test by taking 5% of the distribution and saying, is this interquartile range in the second year, does it fall here or not? If this is in the first year, and this is the Q2, if it falls here, in that 5%, you can say, oh, that's different than the interquartile range in the first year. But there is no way of doing this analytically, because we don't know this distribution. We don't know it. So what this simulation can do is, it can simulate, essentially, that whole situation, and it can give us the actual interquartile range distribution. So here's what they did. They assumed they have the test scores of admitted students in both years. So for all of the admitted students, they have their test scores. And they also have the national distribution of test scores in both years, A and B, the 2 years. National distribution of test scores, that's available. I can show you in... there is a company called Educational Testing Services, ETS. Maybe let me write it. Testing Services, yes. And then Worldwide GRE Score Distribution. I think you can find it. Let's see, show more. I want to see the distribution. Maybe here. they publish it every year. So all the people who've taken the test in a given year, they show you the distribution of the scores, and it's a beautiful normal distribution, of course. Do we have it here? I don't see it. Let's histogram. Well, they publish the mean and standard deviation, at least in this AI view, because it is going to be beautiful normal. I think I've seen also the histograms of them. In any case, they are published. So if they are published, then you have them. You can get those distributions.
Wasn't there a link?
There was a link.
I guess. Mm-hmm. In the how to access the official visual distribution centers.
Okay.
Just click the...
The first one, you think?
I guess.
No.
Unfortunately, no.
But it is a beautiful normal distribution. Don't they state it that it's normal? No, Gaussian? No. It should be quite precisely normal distribution. So we have the distributions of the test scores in both years. And then what you can do is you can just repeat sampling sampling people from each of the two distributions. So you draw a sample from A and B, from the 2 years, of the size is equal to the sizes of admitted students in each of the years. That kind of is maybe a little bit silly, because you are assuming that you are admitting, that your criteria are not selecting some kind of subpopulation of better students, just that. And then you can calculate for each of the samples that you have drawn the interquartile differences for the two samples, and you compare them. Are they bigger than in B than they are in A or not? You count it, and at the end you will have a histogram of their interquartile differences, a distribution like this. And there you can evaluate, you can look at that 5% of the samples, the threshold below which there is 5%, and you can use that to test your hypothesis. So, not a formal procedure in the sense of a closed form solution, you do it essentially by means of simulation. And sometimes we can do it, it's possible to do. If you know how to generate samples, if you know how to generate samples from the distribution. They are useful especially when the sampling distribution is not exactly what the parametric tests require, because we have very good tests for comparing the means. Means are distributed normally, we know it, so to compare means, we assume it's normal, and we can look in a textbook precisely where the threshold is for the 5%. So we don't need to do any simulation. But if we are comparing statistics for which there are no distributions, not no known distributions, then we can just simulate it. The procedure is very similar to this intuitive notion that you can check the power of a bridge, the forces, by building a model of the bridge. And then you can, try to press, you can see how well the bridge will be holding. The same idea, I guess. You build that distribution. If you are doing it in a situation where there are parametric tests, then they found that the Monte Carlo tests may perform a little bit worse than the parametric tests under ideal conditions. So that's essentially the idea. This is the way this thing works. The second idea is known as bootstrap methods. The word bootstrap is used a lot, and it's a funny word, and it's used mainly if you have a small sample and you want to reproduce the properties of the whole population. It's used a lot in computer science, in all kinds of machine learning methods. The funny thing about this bootstrap name is that bootstraps are those in some, you know, cowboy boots or similar boots. There are two loops where you can put your finger in and then use it in pulling the boot on your leg. So these are bootstraps. Bootstrap methods is almost like pulling yourself by your own bootstrap. You get a sample and you try to recreate the properties of the population. And there's a law of large numbers. The larger the sample, the better it reflects the properties of the population. It's a method for estimating the statistical accuracy of any statistical parameters from the data in a single sample. So sometimes you have a single sample and then you want to find out what the population might look like. You need to have a representative sample of the population. That's the starting point, and that's all you need. And they treat that sample as they do resampling from the sample. So they create many samples out of that one sample that you have. And you do it by sampling with replacement. So I think it's on one of the next slides. That here's the procedure. If you have a sample of size n, this is called S, you create another sample by sampling from the sample S with replacement. So you draw a sample R of size n precisely from S with replacement. Suppose you have 100 elements in your sample, 100 numbers, and you sample with replacement. What will happen? You always sample 100 elements with replacement. What will happen is you will have numbers from that sample, but you will have repetitions because you have sample with replacement. So some of the numbers are going to be sampled twice. Even if they are all different, then in the new sample you can have some of the things being repeated. But the statistical properties of that bootstrap sample are going to be very similar to the population. And so you generate many, many samples, and then you can estimate from those samples, you can estimate the sampling distribution. And then you can compare the hypothesis. How do you do that? Here's the test put example. There is a search algorithm that is working, and normally you might be tempted to assume that the mean number of expanded nodes is this jargon that you understand in search. In search, you can view the search space as a tree in which there are nodes. So you find something and you are in a node. You need to remember, for example, those nodes. And the number of expanded nodes may be a measure of how much memory is used, because you may have to remember, you may want to remember some parameters of those nodes. So mean number of expanded nodes may be useful in measuring how good the algorithm is, how much space it uses. So now the problem is, if you have a normal search that always comes back, always finishes, then you may be tempted to have a distribution for that. But the problem is that sometimes you are dealing with censored mean. Censored mean is if the algorithm doesn't come back after 5,000 steps or 5,000, yeah, after 5,000 nodes, it needs to expand more than 5,000, you stop it. Because you assume that the problem is too hard, that the algorithm is not going to do it on time. So now you can ask the question, is the number, mean number of expanded nodes, smaller than 500 for the algorithm? If there was no censorship, then you would be dealing with a distribution that you can assume to be normal, because it's the mean number of, you calculate the mean out of these. Mean out of this should be distributed normally. But the fact that they are censored, that screws up everything, because suddenly it's no longer a normal distribution. The assumptions are not satisfied. It's no longer a normal distribution. So the way you can approach this is you can calculate the mean number of expanded nodes by repeating that distribution many times. If you throw out the outliers, there are too few data points to perform a statistical test, of course, because you don't know the distribution. You cannot, if you take the tail, it's just too few things. So the answer is bootstrapping this sample. You do it, let's say, 1,000 times, but you can do it 1,000,000 times easily. You generate a bootstrap pseudo sample of size 10. Why 10? Because you had 10 numbers here, 10 trials. By sampling with replacement from the set of available measurements S. And then you calculate each time the mean of the obtained pseudo sample. Once you have that, then you have a histogram of the observed mean. That gives you the shape of the distribution. And that shape doesn't have to be normal at all. It can be anything, like something that I have drawn there. And then once you have the distribution, you can easily calculate the cutoff point for the 5%, or whatever alpha level you have decided.
But what are we replacing them with?
Themselves. So when you draw the sample, essentially you draw one number. You need to have a sample of 10. Mm-hmm. So you draw one number. Suppose you draw 610. Mm-hmm. You write it down as one of the numbers, and then put it back in the head. So next time you sample 400, you take 400, you write it down, but you put 400 back. The third time you may end up sampling 610 again. So then in your sample you will have 610 twice. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So it's sampling with replacement, and there will be always 10 numbers in the sample. If you sampled without replacement, then each sample will be identical. Mm-hmm. But because you are doing it with replacement, the samples are going to be different each time. But the consequence of that sampling is that some numbers are going to be repeating. And apparently, again, the statistics tells us that the statistical properties of those bootstrap samples are going to be similar to the population. So if you do that, you have a histogram, and that allows us to perform a test. But the problem is that the histogram will not be the histogram of the H0 distribution, but the histogram of the sampling distribution. So the mean of that distribution is going to be the mean of the sample. And you want compare it to a sample that has the mean of 500. If you want to compare it to a sample with the mean 500, then you should then the distribution that you derive by by sampling is not going to be it's not going to have the mean of 500. It's going to be the mean equal to the mean of the sample. So you need to do something about it. And there are two methods here. There is a shift method and normal approximation method. In the shift method, suppose you derive the distribution, and it looks like something. I'm inventing. Suppose the distribution looks something like this. And that's the distribution derived from the samples using the bootstrap method. You'd like to do this, you know, the 5% to compare a hypothesis, but the problem is that the mean of this distribution, mu b from bootstrap, it's not going to be, I think 100, right? That was the question in the original task. 500. It's going to be 500. If it were 500, then the question is meaningful. Is my observed mean here somewhere? Is it bigger? Is it significantly bigger than 500? Well, you need to look at the distribution with the mean of 500, the shape that you have just derived, and then look at the tail, the 5% of the samples. But the problem is that this mean of the bootstrap samples is not going to be 500. So you need to do something. And one method is the following. Whatever this mu b is, suppose it's 635, what you do is you shift everything in such a way that you repeat that thing, but you shift it to the 500, and then the mean of the sample, that original sample, is whatever it is. I don't know if it's on the slides, whatever it is. Then you can compare if it's indeed significantly bigger than the 500. So this is the shift method. You use this whole bootstrap procedure in order to derive the distribution, but you assume that it's essentially, you shift it to the 500 that you want to compare to. And and that's essentially it. So the only thing you get out of that simulation is the shape of the distribution. In the normal approximation method, you use the bootstrap distribution. You assume that the H0 is normal, so it's not the same as the bootstrap distribution. So you ignore the whole idea of the shape. You assume that the distribution is normal, and this is the 500 mean. The only thing that you don't know is the sigma, but you don't know the variance of the distribution. So the whole bootstrap procedure is to derive just the variance out of that. But you approximate this distribution with the normal. You assume that it's normal. And then you can perform the test, because this is the mean of your sample, not of the bootstrap, but of the sample. And you can compare whether this is significantly bigger or smaller than 500. So this whole procedure is just to derive the sigma, the sigma or sigma squared, the variance. The bootstrap methods have good average properties. Actually, the idea of bootstrap is used a lot in machine learning. Bootstrap is often used to generate samples of the same size with similar properties, in exactly the way that I have shown, sampling with replacement. They have good average properties, bootstrap distributions can be calculated for any statistics, because you essentially multiply the samples. You generate many samples out of one. So then you can look at, you can calculate the statistic for each one of them, and then you can derive the histogram, the distribution of any statistic. It assumes nothing about the population, except for that the sample is representative of the population. It may give you misleading answers for a small percentage of the possible samples, but overall it is working nicely, correctly. The third thing is randomization test, and that's the weirdest, actually, I hope I will be able to explain it well, and then there will be slides comparing the two. So the situations in which you use randomization tests are more limited, because they are used only in to answer one question: are two samples that you have related to each other or not? There is no reference to population at all, so we don't know, we don't care about the population. It's best understood in the example. Randomization tells you whether variables are related or not. That's the only question that they answer. They don't estimate population parameters, and the H0 hypothesis, the classical hypothesis, is there is no relation between the two variables whatsoever. There's no relation. If there is no relation, then you can mix them up. Let me get to the example. So, for example, person A tosses all heads, and person B tosses all tails. Is this an unusual arrangement? And then person A tosses heads. Yes. In the first question here, you are essentially asking: is tosser and the sequence, are they related to one another? In the second question, you ask about the probability of the arrangement here, all heads. If you want to answer the second question, you need to know the underlying distribution, because you need to calculate the probability of that arrangement. If it's a coin, heads, tails, what is the probability of this arrangement? Five heads. 1/2 times 1/2, so 1/2 the power of 5. 1/32. To calculate that, we need to know the underlying distribution. So we need to know the 1/2, the probability of heads. In the first question, we don't even need to know that. It doesn't. We don't care whether probability of heads is 1/2 or something different to answer that question. In question one, we just ask the question: is the person who is tossing related to the sequence? If you assume that it's unrelated, so hypothesis H0, they are unrelated. If you assume that, then you are allowed to throw all 10 results into one head. All 10, so all 5 heads and 5 tails, and then you can draw 5 out of that head for person A, and the remaining ones are for person B. And then you can calculate how likely in that simulation is the situation that you draw 5 heads out of that 10. Question 2, of course, is meaningless unless you specify the distribution, which we just did. Probability of single head is 1/2, so probability of 5 heads is 1/32. In one, the sampling distribution is, asking this question, we know how to sample because we have just 10 outcomes, 5 heads and 5 tails, and we are pulling out sequences of 5. It doesn't generalize to the population. You can ask that question for a very biased coin that has probability 0.2, 0.8 for the outcome. It doesn't really matter. We are not asking that question. If you want to generalize to the distribution, to the population, you need to know the distribution of heads and tails. Exact randomization tests enumerate all possible arrangements, so like you can write out all the possible arrangements of heads and tails. Approximate randomization, you repeat the drawing, essentially. I'm looking at... Okay, here is an example, but there's actually a better example in the later on the slides. Suppose you have three groups of students, and each of the groups has 100 students, and you have these are the scores for 100 questions, and that, of course, the scores are going to be always different. This is the group, and these are the scores, and the questions that you can ask here is when you look at the per measurements, group 1 shows up as the best, group then group 2 and group 3, and then you can ask the question, what is the probability of this result if group is independent of score? So what, you know, being in any of the groups is independent of the score that you get. So then the question is, what is the probability of this result? You can randomize scores across groups, so you can throw all 300 results into one hat, and into one hat. If a group is independent of the score, then you kind of do another permutation. You do different permutations of the three scores. If the group is independent of the score, then you can take 7, put it in the first group, take 2, put in the second. So you can have different permutations of the scores. You can do it exactly. You can look at all the permutations of the first one, second, and then next and next and next up to 100. In the 100th question, you can do a permutation of this course. And then you have 3 to the power of 100, because in every question you have 3 different possibilities, 3 permutations of the 3 numbers. 3, right? Permutations. No, it's actually 6, isn't it? I think it's 6. 3. Isn't it 6 to the power of 100? I just realized there may be an error here. How many permutations are there here? It's 3 factorial. That's 6. I think it should be 6 to the power of 100 possible arrangements. There are 6 arrangements of the first, times 6 of the second, etc. So the number of possible rearrangements is 6 to the power of 100, which is a huge number. You cannot do it. You cannot do that calculation. So you can do approximately. For example, you can select 1 billion different arrangements by doing 1 billion times randomly rearranging the 3 in each of the columns. And then you can calculate in how many of those randomly rearranged scores you get the situation that the group first is the best, group 2 is the second best, and the group 3 is the third best. Because even though they came out to be in this order, maybe the probability of that is not very high if you start rearranging the numbers. So the hypothesis H0 is that group and the this order of which group is the best, they are independent. If so, then we can do this randomization here and check how often in those different billion arrangements group first is the best, better than second and the third. Here is the procedure. So you reassign randomly the scores, the numbers. And the reassignment, the random reassignment, is allowed because we assume that there is no relationship. If there is no relationship, we can rearrange things. You do it k times and get the distribution of the value of interest. And then you can count how often you observe the H0. If the probability of observing H0 is lower than whatever, 5%, then you say, okay, then the group, the two variables must be related. Otherwise, it's very unlikely to see. He also gives a practical example. He gives, okay, these are the interquartile ranges example. If you remember in the previous approach, the interquartile ranges, we had to do the in the Monte Carlo approach, this was where it was given, we were sampling from the distribution of scores available from ETS. Now in this approach, we can assume that we have no idea about that distribution. We don't know what distribution the scores came from. But you say, okay, if the year is independent of the interquartile range, then that allows us to essentially rearrange things. You can just mix them. You can mix the scores from the first year and the second year, and you can calculate the interquartile range for the first year and the second year. You can do it many, many times, and you can check how often the interquartile range in the second year was higher, and that gives you the probability of essentially observing this result given the H0. H0 is saying students' performance is no more variable this year than last year. If this is really true, then you can swap randomly scores between samples, and this will not influence the interquartile range under this H0, of course. So you throw all the scores into one hopper and then you shake them up and draw without replacement this time. So you draw first the 25 and then the remaining are 20. So you randomly create sets of 25, 20 from these 45. You calculate the interquartile range for the first and the second group, randomly selected. And if you do it 500 times, you get you get essentially how often the interquartile ranges were bigger or smaller. If you assume, can you assume that it's a normal distribution? I don't. Don't you need to look at interquartile range? Is it distributed normally or not? I doubt it. We have no idea about this. So maybe you need to look at the distribution. Yeah, you need to construct the distribution of the interquartile ranges. It's actually illustrated in the book, the distribution, for this example. And then the mean of the distribution is this, the standard deviation is this. Observing that minus 2.5 interquartile range is not unusual. It's more probable than the threshold 5%. So you cannot reject H0. So it happened. It could happen randomly. And the probability of observing this randomly is not very high, essentially. We assume that the two samples are drawn from the same population, If so, then you can mix them up and then check how often you see, you observe what you observed in the to start with. Now, can we use randomization for other sample tests? Here is an example, another example that Cohen gives in the book, a paired sample test. You know the difference between paired and normal sample tests. You use it when you, I pressed something. You use it when you are dealing with comparisons that are on that require to look at the same thing. Let me try to come up with the same example. What would be a good thing for a paired test? Here is a good example of a paired test. You give a test to students. Question 1, question 2, question 3. And these are two groups of students, group 1 and group 2. You can say that on the average, let me see if this will work. The hypothesis is that group 2 performed better than group 1. No, that's not a good example. This may be better. Suppose you're studying plants and you have, and this is treatment 1 and treatment 2. And this is plant 1, plant 2, plant 3. And you have some number of plants, let's say 100 plants, that have different properties. The same plant is treated one way or another. But it's the same plant. Or the same human is given two questions. Question 1, question 2. But it's the same person. And then you say that, treatment one is better than treatment 2. You cannot calculate just the mean of that whole thing. You need to look at pairs, because it's the same plant or the same human who is responding to two different treatments. So you need to look at them in pairs. So a paired two test is essentially looking at the same thing for different instances. An example is here. This is the textbook example also. He's describing an experiment in which there are two robots, Alpha and Beta, on two different tasks. Different thing. This may be easier to understand even. There are 10 events in the competition, and there are two robots. And the first robot performs Alpha on the first task, is better than Beta on this task. The second task is also better. The third tasks, they are the same. And these are the differences in performance. The mean difference is 1.8. So the robot I think robot alpha is better than robot beta. So now the question that you can ask is robot alpha indeed better than robot beta? You would need to use a paired test. You need to compare it on each of the tasks. If you now say, okay, hypothesis H0 is that alpha and beta are equal in each event. So essentially it doesn't matter. They are the same, just as good, both of them. Two sports people, two students on different questions. They are pretty much the same. That's H0. H1 is, no, they are not different. Say alpha is better than beta. On a one-tailed test. One-tailed test and two-tailed test, you remember what it is? That's different type of hypothesis H0. If you have a distribution and you ask, is the mean 1 equal to mean 2? That's H0. H1 will be the two means are not equal to each other. So this is H0, this is H1. If this is the setup, then you are dealing with two-tailed tests. They are not equal when the mean, this is mean 1, mean 2 falls here or there. It's far enough from that one. The hypothesis is not equal. Is a two-tailed test. You need to, the 5% significance level has to be the sum of the two areas. So this is 2.5% and this is 2.5%, each of the tails. Together, it's 5%. It's a two-tailed test. One-tailed test is when you have the same situation, but the question that you are asking is, so this is one. This is mu 1, H0 is, mu 2 is larger, sorry, it's smaller or equal than mu 1, H1 is, mu 2 is larger than mu 1. So, the robot is, 2 is better than robot 1, and H0 is, it's the same or worse. Example, you compare the height of women and men. You can ask, are heights of men and women the same or different on the average? Or you can ask, are men on the average taller than women? If you ask, are they taller than women, you are dealing with one-tailed test. Because the hypothesis is going to be rejected only if the average height of men is bigger than, significantly bigger than that one. If you ask, are they the same or different? So are men different in height than women? You are dealing with a two-tailed test. You reject the null hypothesis that they are the same if men are going to be significantly shorter than women or significantly taller than women. So that's one or two-tailed test, and it just depends on what kind of question you ask. But it makes intuitive sense when you look at that comparison. So now H0 is they are equal in each event, so I guess H1 is they are not equal. There is a difference between them. And that's... is it paired sample test? Is it one tail? It's two-tailed essentially, because are they different or are they the same? If they are the same under H0, then you can shake again within a pair. You can shake them. In other words, you can permutate them again, just like in the other example. And for each of the permutation, you can again check, look at the differences, and then you can calculate the mean difference. you shuffle members of each pair. So 7, 8, 8, 7, yes? 3, 0, 0, 3, 9, 9, 6, 4, 6, 4, shuffled, unchanged, etc. And then you do it many, many times. You calculate, you have the histogram, you have the distribution of the differences for each of the simulated thing. And then it allows you to, again, test the null hypothesis. The kind of general thing is that we have to think in this context is it takes some ingenuity. You need to always ask yourself, what is the hypothesis? What does it allow me to do? In randomization tests especially, this is probably the hardest of the three. What is it that I can change under the null hypothesis? What kind of things can I randomize? Takes a little bit of thinking always. Monte Carlo, draw samples from a population that is known. You understand the population, you know what it is. It allows you to generate, to essentially build a bridge, because you understand the principles, you can build the model, and then you can check things. That's Monte Carlo. Coin tossing, a good example, because we understand the probability of different outcomes in coin tossing. Sorry, randomization, okay. In randomization allows you to just change the ordering, mix the populations. If you begin with a sample sequences 1 and 2, in randomization pseudo-sample, you can draw from, you can put them all in one hat and then draw 5 and 5 and then see what happens. Every randomized pseudo-sample will have exactly 5 heads and 5 tails, because there were 5 heads and 5 tails in this to start with. There's a narrower range of results than in Monte Carlo sampling distributions. Sorry, this is disturbing us a little. Bootstrap R with replacement, randomization is without replacement. It's a big difference. If you have a sample like this, the best estimate of probability 1 in the population is 0.5 in the bootstrap. In randomization, it's exactly 0.5. In bootstrap, there is a possibility that you get 6 ones. You can calculate that probability. In bootstrap, the probability is in randomization is 0, because it's just a different permutation of these things, different combination of these things. Let me see if there is any. I'm out of time, so I want to. Randomization is just probability of rearrangements, arrangements, rearrangements. With randomization, it's a simple hypothesis, really. Are the two things related? What is the probability of disarrangement of data? The power, randomization are very powerful. Bootstrap are slightly less powerful. Cohen did some experiments himself about the two tests, reports some results. You may not remember the exact elements of the procedure, but you should remember that it's possible to do creatively in situations when you don't know the distribution. You can still perform classical hypothesis testing using one of the three approaches. The classical tests, you know, where all the assumptions are satisfied, the reasons for that are becoming less and less convincing, because we can use computation to perform the procedure without the closed-end solution. So I realize the three procedures are a little bit confusing. You would have to kind of think and sit down and think about them. But they are possible to do under certain circumstances. You need to think about the situation, and creatively you can find a way of doing them. I'm out of time terribly, actually, two minutes over, so I should finish here. If you have any questions about them, we'll still should have some time next week. Next week is going to be not very long. I'll present you an idea of another type of simulations that is known as artificial societies. Very, very nice, very, very interesting, a new way of doing science. I'm going to stop the recording and we'll see you next week. Remember that next week we'll finish a little earlier, probably 15 minutes before time, 5 to 7.